Of course, I hope most of you took critical thinking or something of the sort when you started your philosophy. So the genetic fallacy is basically arguing against the source rather than the person or the argument itself. So in this case, in my argument, it's the same thing, but it's also a fallacy to do with genes as well. So it has a kind of double meaning in this paper. So the genetic fallacy is committed against a field called evolutionary psychology. If some of you haven't heard about it, I'll give you a little explanation about it. Evolutionary psychology is basically a field that posits that our brain is, I guess every cognitive theory posits that our brain is a product of evolution, but evolutionary psychology goes a little further and posits that our brain is so specialized due to evolution that it has discrete modules which are similar to organs found within the rest of our body. So we have, for example, a heart and lungs, and they all perform very different functions. And our brain is separated similarly. So we have modules, for example, for to cut it really widely, language, perception, mathematical abilities, spatial abilities, right? But when it comes to evolutionary psychology, the strongest adherence of evolutionary psychology posits something called massive modularity. So that they state that the brain is separated into hundreds, maybe even thousands, of distinct modules. Now, one major argument against this cognitive theory is what I call the genetic argument. No author has really made a huge, given a whole paper or a full treatise based on this argument, but you can find it in almost any paper where evolutionary psychology is argued against, or some kind of genetic basis to human uniqueness is argued against. And so the argument, to put it in a sentence, is that humans lack sufficient unique genes to account for our massive modularity. And the evidence usually stated in order to support this argument is twofold. The first one is the human genome comprises only 20,000 genes. This is a very recent figure, so no author has made this statement, but the figure that they normally use is between 30,000 and 40,000, and that comes from the Human Genome Project from 1999. But recently, from 2004, they've reduced that number from 30,000 to 40,000 to 20,000 to 5,000. The second piece of evidence is that humans and chimpanzees have a 98.5 or 98.7 or somewhere around that environment genetic similarity. So let's look at a few quotes where this argument has been made. Basically, I realized that this argument was very popular at a talk that was, or a conference that was given at the University of Waterloo called Cultural Biology Conference, where a bunch of researchers presented their ideas showing how human uniqueness could be due to cultural evolution rather than genetic evolution. So Paul Churchland, this one is my favorite, because he's not only making the genetic argument, but he's making some very, very bad neuroscientific assumptions here. How on earth to code for the individual connection places and connection strengths of fully 10 to the 14 synapses using the resources of an evolved genome that contains only 30,000 genes, 90% of which, all but a paltry 3,000 of which, we share with mice. All right, and I hope everyone knows who Paul Churchland is. Elvin et al., they had a book they released in 1996, which is a very popular book in cognitive science, showing the viability of a cognitive theory called connectionism. So in this quote, they argue against evolutionary psychology, saying that we have 98.4 genetic material in common with chimpanzees, and that 93% are shared between the chimp and the old world monkey. Yet those two, we believe, look so much more similar than we do to chimps, even though they have a greater genetic difference than we do to chimps. Stephen Quartz and Sitnowski, I forget his first name. I think it's Stephen as well. They released a paper called The Constructivist Manifesto, another very famous paper showing environmental influence and brain development. And basically, their theory called constructivism, they believe that somehow it relieves what they call they talk about genetic burden of genetic mechanisms called for by evolutionary psychology. Alan Mazur, big name in sociology, he makes similar arguments, and basically his argument is that somehow language gives us the power to do our great human feats, and his paper is something like, take a chimp, add language, melt the glaciers. So, you know, with language we're able to do our massive environmental effects. And Gary Marcus, who, funnily enough, he's an evolutionary psychologist himself, and he himself makes the genetic argument. And what his project is trying to do is trying to show that with the 1.5 genetic difference, we can have the massive modularity that evolutionary psychology calls for. So it's interesting that even evolutionary psychologists make this argument, which I will soon show is a mistake. So what are the problems that I want to show in this paper? Well, the main problem is that, and I wish I could just end it at this, genetics is really tricky. All right, there's so much more to it than a simple count of genes or a simple percentage comparison among genomes. So the specific problems that I'll look at, the first one is that the genetic underpinning equals more than the sum of one genes. I should change that to biological underpinning, because what I want to show also is that it's not only your genes that specify who you are biologically. Second problem is that humans and chimpanzees differ more than 1.5%. This is a very recent finding within the past few years, so I guess it's still one that's quite in contention, but basically I'd like to show that the 98.5 figure is not set in stone by any means. And lastly, that most changes in species are due to changes in gene regulation, rather than what genes are coded. What does this mean? I'll show in a bit. So before I get on to that, give a little genetics lesson. I know a lot of you have not done biology probably since high school, so or grade 11 in high school. So if you're from Ontario, sorry. Anyway, central dogma in molecular biology. This is something that I learned even in university. They call it the central dogma. And basically it states that you have DNA prescribes RNA, and RNA translates into polypeptides or proteins. All right, very simple formula. Great thing about this formula too is it doesn't go backwards, which supports Darwinism, as opposed to Lamarckianism, which was another popular evolutionary theory back in the 19th century and part of the 20th century as well. All right, what are each of these things? Okay, well, sorry, I'm assuming very little here, trying to make sure that we're all on track. DNA, double-stranded nucleotide chain, that's passed from parent to offspring. So if we remember back to the work of Crick and Watson, DNA is a double helix. And the reason it's a double helix is because double helix is a very stable chain. It can be copied with very high fidelity, very low chance of mistakes. It's found mostly in eukaryotes, meaning any non-bacterial organisms. Bacteria only have RNA, which is a single-stranded nucleotide, which in eukaryotes is transcribed, or in other words, for copying from DNA. So it's a single strand of nucleotides. All right, the alphabet for DNA is made up of four letters: adenine, cytosine, thymine, and guanine. Thank you. So, on one chain, you may have, say, these things, and they get paired with its complement on the other chain. The alphabet for RNA is almost exactly the same thing, made up of four letters as well, but instead of T or thymine, you have uracil. All right, and uracil binds with adenine as well. So in this process, in transcription, basically one of the strands of DNA is transcribed into an RNA chain. From here, RNAs are translated into proteins, which basically carry out most of the functions in our cells. So apart from water, a lot of us is protein. All right, so the way this is done is that RNA, the sequence can be separated into triplets. So let's say this is ATG. This gets translated into methionine, which is one of the 20 amino acids. And this happens, the translation works by a universal code, which is found in almost, well, basically in all organisms. There are some exceptions here and there. All right, so each triplet gets transcribed into different amino acids, and these amino acids are then joined to make a polypeptide chain. All right, so in this way, you have proteins being coded by DNA. I hope everyone sees that. That's your crash course, genetics 101. Move on to the Human Genome Project. Well, the main project for the Human Genome Project was to find the DNA sequence, which doesn't mean that it's finding the genes. All right, finding the gene comes later. So the human genome is made up of 3×10⁹ nucleotides. So basically, it's finding the sequence along the DNA chain. All right. Secondary project was to find genes. Now, how is that different? The difference is that, well, basically, you just have a string of letters. And let's say you're translating another language or listening to someone else speak a different language. If you're hearing someone speak a different language, it's not clear right away where the words are in that language. You have to become familiar with that language in order to split up what they're saying or their group of phonemes into different words. And that's what finding genes is. It's finding where the words are in that sequence. Now, two approaches are used to find genes. The first approach, and these both approaches were used in the Human Genome Project, is called the ab initio approach. And what that does is it looks for telltale signs of where genes might be. So along the DNA chain, there's basically sequences of letters that you look for that point to where a gene might be, where a gene might start, where it might end. Okay? Now, this differs from organism to organism, from species to species, from, well, not organism to organism, but from different species, and from gene to gene as well. Different genes may have different places where they have the codes telling where to stop and where to end. So one, the program used by the Human Genome Project is a program called GenScan. So this program has the whole sequence, and it looks through, kind of like Google. You give Google a word, and it looks through various documents looking for that word. So GenScan looks for these telltale signs of genes, and says, okay, here's a gene, and then you get the count at the end. Ab initio, they generally overestimate, because you give them, basically, these telltale signs that might not work for every gene. So they find more genes than one would generally predict within an organism. The second approach is called a comparative approach, where we compare our sequence of genes, a sequence to genes found in other organisms. Now, these genes were found by other methods, for example, knocking out nucleotides in these genes to see if it makes a difference in the expression of that gene. So no computational techniques are really used. It's basically an experimental technique. So you find these genes in other organisms, and you check whether these same genes are found in humans, the human genome. The program used by the Human Genome Project was called Ensemble. So basically, it takes the sequence in other organisms. So you have this particular sequence, and you compare it to what's found in the human genome. And this generally underestimates because, of course, we predict that the human genome should have novel genes that are not found in other organisms, or genes that are changed sufficiently so that the matching isn't that great. So what do? You average these two. Right, and of course, it's not a quick average. They have theories as to how you should average them, and it's based on what's found in the programs as well. So what are the results? Well, the IHGC, International Human Genome Consortium, first released their results in 1999. 90% of the genome was sequenced, and they found somewhere on the order of 30,000 to 40,000 genes within the genome, and that was the result that I gave at the beginning of the paper. 2004, 99.9% of the genome was sequenced. So only 1 in 1,000 nucleotides is still not known. But that's pretty damn good. And to that estimate, they've dropped it down from 20,000 to 25,000 genes, which, you know, once you look at that, it's very, very small, especially when you compare it to other species. Nematode, by comparison, has 18,000 genes. Nematode is a flatworm, one of the most basic forms of life. It's like a couple steps up from jellyfish, right? And then you compare it to rice. And plants in general, for some reason, have tons and tons of genes. So rice have almost three times more genes than we do. Why do they have any genes? I don't know. Maybe aliens are communicating with them instead of us. But last finding, genes are found only on 2% of our genome. So the other 98% looks like it's doing absolutely nothing. Another main project is the genetic comparisons, where they get the 98.7%. That should be a percent instead of a 5. I guess that's just the higher number. And this was first found by King and Wilson in 1975. And they did this with a very really neat approach, where they formed DNA hybrids. And this is an experimental approach as opposed to a computer approach. So what you do, you take two DNA strands, one from one species, so let's say humans, and the other from another, chimps. And you subject them to increasing temperatures. And what do? When you subject chemicals to increasing temperatures? Well, they blow up. They basically separate. And based on the temperature needed to completely separate these two strands, you're able to predict how much similarity there are between these two strands. Well, King and Wilson found that humans and chimps if you do this process, have 98.7% genetic similarity. And this result, along using computational studies, have been supported in this subsequent study, the latest one from 1995. So what does this all say? Well, very likely that monkeys are uncles, right, genetically speaking. We're very, very similar to them. And that any difference that we do have is not going to amount to much. So what a lot of authors interpret is that human differences need other non-genetic explanations. How is that the case? Let's look at the prompts. All right, for your next lesson in genetics, we'll present the new dogma of molecular biology. Think of the DNA rather than a sentence in the book, more like a zip file in your computer. Right? How does a zip file work? All right, so when you have your computer program, at bottom, it's made up of a bunch of zeros and ones. And what a zip file does is it looks for patterns within this sequence, and it transforms it into something smaller. Now, I'm not sure if this works exactly, but it transforms it based on those patterns into something smaller, so that once you decode it, it produces this pattern again. Of course, you have to use the same program in encoding and decoding. So the same thing works with DNA, RNA, and polypeptides. Basically, they're codes, and they have to be decoded. So this section of DNA not only makes this section of RNA, which corresponds to this section of protein, you basically have multiple realizability. Yeah? 2 minutes? All right. So how does this work? So basically, if you think about it that way, you have a lot more RNA, you have a lot more proteins. Okay? Two quick examples, alternative splicing. So your DNA is made up of things called introns and exons. All right? And normally it was thought that introns weren't decoded and exons were. But now they're finding that they are. And the decoding can occur along different sections. All right? Same thing with proteins. Proteins can be cut up into different sections. So to take a very conservative estimate, a lot of biologists believe that one DNA section can produce between 10 to 100 different proteins. All right? And these are a lot of different phenomena where genes are decoded or DNA sequences are decoded so that it gives various different phenomena. To do with genetic similarity, what previous studies have failed to check are things called indels, or insertions in deletions. And I wish I could describe what these are, but hopefully you'll, after this you'll look it up on your own. But basically, these taking into account indels, and these aren't just out of the way publishings. These are publishings in the National Academy of Science, which is probably the top science journal. One study found that there's a difference of 13% between humans and chimpanzees. And lastly, there are non-genetic differences that could occur that can cause the differences between species. So for genes, you have the gene itself, which tells what is made, and you have a region, which is called the regulatory region, which describes how much of this is being coded and when, so the timing and the amount. And basically, the way that I like to think about this is you give two kids the same set of Lego sets, and they'll build completely different things, right? And this is what a lot of biologists are showing, that most species differences are due to the differences of these regulatory regions, not in the differences in what is coded. All right, so what's the conclusion? Well, it's very likely that genomic differences are greater than simple interpretations would show. Another problem is trying to interpret what a gene is. Is a gene just a simple DNA sequence? If it is, then we have to recognize that that gene is responsible for many different products. So the status of evolutionary psychology, I'm not claiming that it is now preferable over other cognitive theories. These results don't show right away, okay, we must accept evolutionary psychology. I'm just simply saying that the jury is still out on this question, that if you're going to use genetics to support your that you simply can't use genetics yet to support your cognitive theory, and that what we need at least is to show the mechanisms that are occurring between genes and neurological structures, and we're still a long, long way from that point. Thank you very much.
Okay, so you started that your presentation with the two different types of modularity that modularity where certain sections of the brain do particular things, and then you talked about massive modularity. Now, I'm not sure if I missed this bit, but I'm not quite sure how what followed related back to massive modularity or modularity on the lower scale. Mm-hmm. Could you maybe say a little bit more about the connection?
What followed in the sense of my problems or the interpretations that the other authors made based on genetic arguments?
I don't understand.
Okay. Well, basically, if you're asking for massive modularity, what you're asking for is these structures that are highly defined innately, or at least if you have some environmental influence, then they form along these predictable lines. So as a result, it seems intuitive that such massive modularity needs a lot of coding, a lot of instructions as to how these structures have to be made. Whereas other theories, other cognitive theories, such as constructivism or connectionism, they basically postulate these blank slate type neurons. So you just have this neuron, right, and based upon the messages that they get from the environment. Constructivism, for example, just says, okay, just build more dendrites, more connections, all right, whereas connectivism says, okay, well, just alter the weights between these, between synapses. So it's just like a changes in the neurons themselves as opposed to this larger structure, okay? So basically what I'm saying is that if you have more coding going on, I'm showing that there's more coding than what a simple interpretation would show. So as a result, the possibility of massive modularity is still there.
Okay. I'm just interested in the connection between what you're doing here, mm-hmm. and I'm sure it's a wild leap to the sort of thing that Evo Wilson has been doing, that is to observe the behavior of social animals in the wild. And right. I know there's a huge leap between this kind of approach and the experience in behavior. Do you have anything to say about that?
Well, I guess ultimately, yeah, genes are related to traits. What E.O. Wilson was doing was, sociobiology was simply looking at behavior and traits, like with what you said. Evolutionary psychology likes to, well, the advantage that sociobiology had was, okay, you have this gene, it goes to this trait, okay? Evolutionary psychology is looking at the between stage, right? So it's looking at mental structures as well. So the advantage that sociobiology had is, you know, it didn't have to worry about this stuff, right? So So both of them, I guess, have to do with sociobiology. But since nobody really talks about sociobiology anymore, I decided to concentrate on evolutionary psychology. But eventually, they amount to the same thing.
But why doesn't anybody talk about
that? Well, basically, the fad went that with Stephen Jay Gould and Richard
Lewontin,
that's right, with their paper, the Spandrels San Marco, right, they showed that these things were just simply ways of supporting the architect, or what was it? Basically, it was restricted on previous architectural and engineering principles that they had, whereas a lot of engineers and architects were talking about how these things were advantageous on their own, and they basically showed the analog between sociobiology and the latter interpretation, and they showed no, these are just restrictions on the genome, and it has nothing to do with adaptations, right? So the behaviors that we have, it's basically, you can't say that it's directly linked to these particular genes or particular evolutionary advantages, adaptations. It's more like exaptation. So basically that paper, I'm sorry, I'm not doing much justice with that paper, basically, it's just a lot of people like that paper for some reason. They didn't like sociology. Evolutionary psychology came from the ashes decades later. Right, it's another attempt.
Well, and what was Wilson's reply? You know about the problems.
Yeah.
And Wilson wanted. I don't want to get too far away from what you're doing.
Right. Well, Wilson has he had a lot of different replies, but I guess it's still. I mean, you know, a lot of people took that to stock, but I guess a little bit more into intuition failed.
I'll tell you something about that.
Sure.
I wonder how the couple of things you mentioned at the end, of course. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say, I'd like to talk to them, but they're right at the beginning of your time. I wasn't here for them. Fit together. Namely, once you take on board the point that the pleiotropisms between the mediate, the genes themselves, the expressions,
mm-hmm.
Are so subtle, they can be so complex,
mm-hmm.
It's so far from being one-to-one or even any sort of easily formulable many-to-one sort of relationship.
Right.
But I wonder what the payoff is of emphasizing the different ways that you can spell out the distinctions between, say, chimp genome and ours. Well, you know, it's 2% difference if you count this way, or it's 8 if you count this way, it's 13 if you count this way. Does that really matter once we take on board the idea that the differences can be really very, very tiny, and yet the expressions, right, the differences in the genome can be very, very tiny, the expressions can be enormous.
Right. Well, one argument that can be made that even though the expressions can be very quite varied, they're not that different for us as chimps.
No, they don't have to be.
No, they don't have to be, but it's still.
Well, I guess part of what you're saying is that you could have very, very small differences.
Right.
And yet these would result in enormous differences when it comes to the expression of the genes.
Right.
In aggregate, right? When all of them are taken together.
Yeah.
So once you take that on board, and then, you know, as you observe, the actual differences in expression are huge. Why does it matter whether the difference is 2%, 8%, or 2%?
Right. I guess it's just another, you know, here you go, here's another piece of evidence to show you. So yeah, I agree. Both, I think that both pieces of evidence are very strong. But together.
Oh, just to mention, I once had a conversation with a creationist where I mentioned the massive overlap of genetic material as evidence for recent common ancestry. And I think I said I used the 98% thing.
Oh yeah,
everyone uses that. I didn't reply with a question. That impressed me. It's not like it's 100%.
Right. That's a very good reply from creationists for us. Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Smoking, etc., all done it. And we'll meet you back here at 11:40 for our next talk. Sorry, as long as we're asking questions off, can
right.
I just have a sort of show of hands before we go into that? Because I need to. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.